Shots fired, shots returned, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Former GOP candidate Mitt Romney says Donald Trump is dangerous for America.
This is the very brand of anger that has led other nations into the abyss.
Trump fires back, says Romney's irrelevant. Also, an immigrant who likes Trump's wall idea.
He will build a beautiful fence, and it doesn't mean he doesn't like the Mexican people, but they need to come legally.
Plus, an Italian writer pretends to be an American politician named Alex.
Alex, for me, is real because Alex talks about issues which he really believes.
That's today here on The World. Thanks for being with us. Some real fireworks today among Republicans. We haven't heard much from him since 2012, but former GOP candidate Mitt Romney turned bulldog today. He went after Donald Trump big time.
Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University. He's playing the members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat.
Romney called Trump a disaster for America's image abroad, dangerous when it comes to national security, and that he's fueling America's enemies. Trump wasted no time responding. He labeled Romney irrelevant.
Mitt is a failed candidate. He failed. He failed horribly.
I spoke with Politico's national editor, Kristen Roberts, just after Romney's speech. She made it clear Romney was not speaking just for himself.
There's no difference between the GOP leadership and Mitt Romney. They both represent the elite of the party, and it's an elite that has been at its absolute wit's end over Donald Trump. They do not know what to do. They do not know how they got to this place. But I'll tell you this, the things that he said and the presentation he made speak to exactly why the GOP cannot defeat Donald Trump. Mitt Romney went out there and said these incredible words, historic, really, for the past nominee to come out against the same party's front runner. But he refused to pick a side. He refused to pick between Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or even John Kasich. So, you know, what we're seeing here is, yes, a party elite fretting. The bigger question is, does it matter?
Well, let's listen to a bit more of what Mitt Romney said, because he placed Donald Trump not just in the context of the 2016 presidential race, but in the context of the world. Here.
The president of the United States has long been the leader of the free world. The president and, yes, even the nominees of the country's great parties helped define America to billions of people around the world.
And then Governor Romney went on.
Mr. Trump's bombast is already alarming our allies and fueling the enmity of our enemies.
So, Kristen, is that too strong, alarming our allies?
I don't think it's too strong at all. One of the very interesting things we're seeing here in Washington is coming out of the embassies. Now, diplomats won't talk to you on the record, but I will tell you the staff for almost every one of the U.S. allies who have embassies in Washington are wringing their hands. They don't know what to make of this. And that's not only because they put themselves out there a year ago and told their home countries, don't worry about Donald Trump. It's Jeb Bush's game. It's because they're actually worried about the impact of some of these incredible statements Trump has made. Everything from rapists coming into Mexico to things about ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the fight against Muslim extremism. The man is saying things that are just not typically said by people who want to occupy the Oval Office.
Now, Romney didn't just bash Trump. He was also pretty clear that he thinks the real enemy is Hillary Clinton and that this, quote, untrustworthy and dishonest person doesn't deserve to be handed the White House by Donald Trump. So is Romney's concern really Donald Trump and the U.S. status within the world, or is it just preventing a Democrat from being in the White House?
You know, to be fair, I think it's both. And I think that those are equally relevant for the party and the party elites overall. I mean, certainly they do not want the Democrats to have the White House. And that's particularly important in this presidential cycle because there will be a Supreme Court replacement. They also really don't want Donald Trump to be the nominee. And I think the belief right now, based not just on external polling and internal polling, but just a gut feeling, is that Donald Trump would lose to Hillary Clinton. Now, I will tell you that some of the polls say that Some don't. But if what we're seeing in the primary calendar and with the amount of people coming to the polls state after state after state for Donald Trump, I think the fight between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton would not be such a success for Hillary Clinton as many of the Republicans now fear.
Politico's Kristen Roberts there. Mitt Romney's not the only one voicing opposition to Donald Trump's candidacy. Many immigrants question his policies, especially his proposal to build a wall along our southern border. But Trump also has supporters among immigrants, people like Pola Hansberger of Florida. She's with the nonprofit Legal Immigrants for America, and she fondly remembers her first years in the U.S. after immigrating from Nicaragua in 1964.
It was an amazing adventure. We fell madly in love with the people. I remember living in downtown Los Angeles and leaving the door open. The milk would come. The milk person would come and leave the milk outside with no need to worry about being robbed or anything. Those were amazing days. We felt safe in our homeland, which was America.
So as an immigrant to the U.S., what is the appeal of a man, Donald Trump, who says we need to build a wall on the border to deal with illegal immigration?
Well, in my country, we had to build walls with barbed wires or broken bottles at the top to prevent people from entering our home and taking everything that wasn't bolted down and maybe even causing harm. I don't want to live like that. We better have one wall, one magnificent wall, instead of people having to wall themselves out or having alarms and to live behind bars. I'm sorry, that's not a very good experience. They are free and we are not. We become prisoners in our own home. So I say Donald Trump will build. He's a builder. He will build a beautiful fence. And it doesn't mean he doesn't like the Mexican people. I love them too. We love mankind, but they need to come legally.
Your experiences with walls and fences, I mean, you're talking about a private home. When we talk about a whole country that has prided itself on its inclusivity and bringing in people from all over the world like yourself, I mean, isn't that different?
We are here. I came legally. My sister, during the Sandinista Contra Revolution, the house was bombed and had to depart in a hurry and go to Los Angeles to seek political asylum. And she did it successfully. We went and waited 7 years for them to get the residency. And eventually everyone, all six members of the family, became members. So I believe that if you come to a country, whatever country that is, you should do things legally. You should not do things illegally.
I was really kind of struck by the way you described life in the United States when you first came here in the 60s. You could leave your doors unlocked and no problems. When Donald Trump talks about making America great again, what do you think about it? Is it those early days when you got here when it was kind of a, let's say, a kinder, gentler America, even though there was a lot of stuff going on that wasn't so kind and gentle?
See, he reminds me of, in a way, of my husband. I married a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and he reminds me of him because my husband was a businessman that negotiated contracts for his organization in different countries in the world. And thank God he did well. And you need to have a special kind of a mind to be able to negotiate contracts that are good. And I think that Donald Trump has that advantage.
Pola Hansberger with the nonprofit Legal Immigrants for America. Okay, let's talk about an issue on which the Republican candidates seem to agree. All say they would all take a sharp turn away from President Obama's policies on climate change. And that could have big consequences for the global climate agreement that the U.S. helped broker in Paris back in December. From our environment desk, here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
The Paris Agreement on curbing climate change wouldn't have happened without U.S. leadership. For those hoping the country will stay on that course, the electoral answer is Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. They both accept the established science that climate change is largely man-made, and they mostly have backed President Obama's climate policies. The Republican candidates, not so much.
Today, the global warming alarmists are the equivalent of the flat earthers.
That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate.
Rubio, Cruz, and Ohio Governor John Kasich say they'll scrap Obama's Hallmark Clean Power Plan. That's a cornerstone of the climate commitments the U.S. made in Paris. As for billionaire Donald Trump, he hasn't weighed in on that policy, but he did tell Fox News he would cut the agency responsible for limiting carbon pollution.
Environmental protection, what they do is a disgrace. Every week they come out with new regulations. They make it impossible.
Who's going to protect the environment?
We'll be fine with the environment. We can leave a little bit, but you can't destroy businesses.
All of this puts international proponents of strong climate action more than a little on edge.
This is generally seen as a very, very big deal.
Henrik Salin is a Swede who teaches at Boston University. He's been studying international environmental negotiations for 20 years, and he says he and his colleagues are closely tracking this election.
The United States is the second largest emitter in the world, and you're not going to get the desired reductions in greenhouse gas emissions without very substantive U.S. participation.
The environmental regulations established during the Obama administration put the U.S. on its way toward meeting the carbon reductions it agreed to in Paris. But according to David Goldston at the Natural Resources Defense Council Action Fund, those regulations are not set in stone.
Many of them can be reversed. In some cases, there are a lot of hurdles to doing that. But in the end, I mean, presidents, especially if they have a Congress that's willing to go along, totally shape U.S. climate policy and can reshape it.
Then there's the Supreme Court. Justice Antonin Scalia cast a decisive vote for a stay of the Clean Power Plan days before he died. The court will likely decide the plan's ultimate fate, so its survival could hinge on whether a Republican or a Democrat names Scalia's replacement. Now, green energy technologies are developing quickly, and renewables are challenging fossil fuels on cost, so U.S. carbon emissions may fall regardless of who's in the White House. But still, if the Clean Power Plan disappears with the next president, much of the United States' global influence goes with it.
Obama, when he promised that the U.S. would be a leader in international climate policy, they leaned heavily on the Clean Power Plan.
That's Guri Bong from the Center for Climate Change Research in Norway. Bong says if a new president scrapped the power plan regulations,
this would sort of bring the U.S. into a situation where it has very low credibility in international agreements.
Europeans have already committed to deeper carbon cuts than the U.S., and they really don't want their transatlantic partners to do even less under a new president. That's according to Miranda Schroers, who heads the Environmental Policy Research Center at the Free University of Berlin. She says she's sat on a dozen panels in the past 2 months dealing with this post-Paris world.
And there's not a single panel that I've been on where it hasn't been discussed.
Schroers says Europeans hope the Clean Power Plan, tightened gas mileage standards, and proposed methane limits passed under Obama last into the next presidency. But if they don't, she's worried. Carbon cuts in the Paris Agreement are voluntary, so every country is going to be looking over the fence to see if the guy next door is keeping up his end of the bargain.
Without the U.S. showing leadership, you can't expect that China or India or Brazil or Nigeria or South Africa are going to be willing to act. And I think that's the biggest fear, that if you have a climate skeptic in office, that could be really a problem for moving forward with the implementation of the Paris Agreement.
In other words, without continuing support from the U.S., the Paris Agreement could collapse. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Words coming out of my mouth into your ear, and you understand what I'm saying. I mean, let's face it. That's totally remarkable. And I'm not talking about the technology of radio, just the organic process of you hearing words and understanding them. You don't even need formal training. We just learn when we're young to speak and comprehend much of our native languages. Patrick Cox is here. He's the host of our podcast on language, The World in Words. You think about this stuff all the time, Patrick, and it is really miraculous. So what is the secret?
Well, if I knew the secret, I would be a very rich man. But we do know an awful lot more than we used to, partly because there's been a renewed interest in bilingualism.
So people who speak two languages, how is it actually helping?
Well, when it comes to studying the bilingual brain, researchers tend to focus on two groups of people, the elderly and the very young. So with the elderly, there have been studies that have found that knowing two languages and using them every day, that may delay the onset of memory loss, sometimes even forms of dementia. Not everyone is convinced, but several studies have come to similar conclusions. With the very young, the studies often focus on language acquisition in bilingual settings. So you might have parents who speak a different mother tongue from one another, or you might have studies of immigrant groups.
So what are we finding out then with the very young about how we acquire these words?
Well, researchers are able to go further and further back into our personal linguistic histories. It used to be cutting edge to study two-year-olds, but now the action is in the womb.
Wow. How do you even perform a study like that in the womb on acquisition of words?
Well, that's the very question that we had. So we asked the world's Ari Daniel to take a look at a couple of these studies and the methodology that they used. And as you'll hear, they're analyzing sounds rather than words, and they're looking at some very subtle differences in rhythm and pitch.
We'll start by going retro. It's the 80s. You live in Britain, and you watch soaps, including one from Australia called Neighbours.
Neighbours. Everybody needs good neighbors.
This is the theme song. And in the late 80s, a British psychologist published a study showing that pregnant moms who watch Neighbors every day gave birth to babies who reacted more strongly to the theme song than those whose moms didn't watch the show.
That is the first paper which has shown that fetuses can be exposed to a specific type of sound and then elicit some sort of a reaction to them after they have been born.
Eino Partanen is a Finnish neuroscientist at Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. Partanen wasn't involved in the soap opera study, but it's inspired a bunch of his work, including a cool thing he and his colleagues tried a few years ago while in Finland. They took a group of pregnant moms, and for 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, during their last trimester, he asked them to play this, loud.
Wow. It doesn't sound like a Finnish music hit.
No, sadly. Even for Finns, that would be annoying.
How do you find moms that want to do that?
Through friends and relatives who don't dare to say no, mostly.
Plus through internet discussion boards. And occasionally in the recording, the middle syllable of the ta-ta-ta sequence would be swapped out for a different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.
Did you hear that? It's subtle. Ta-to-ta.
Ta-to-ta.
Or it would be swapped out for a different pitch.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.
And then, just days after they were born, Partanen played the stimuli to the newborns and used an EEG to monitor their brain activity. He compared it to a group of newborns who didn't receive the in utero ta-ta-ta stimulation. The results couldn't be clearer. Both groups of babies responded identically to the sequence with the different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta.
Because that second vowel's heard all the time in Finnish. You don't need a special recording to be exposed to it as a fetus. But only the babies who'd been exposed in utero to the pitch change recognize it once they're born. And that's because, just as in English, pitch isn't relevant in Finnish, compared to some languages, Chinese for example, where words take on different meanings based on pitch. So babies that don't hear different pitches in utero don't respond to them later. Or, more simply, babies respond to the signals they first hear in utero. And of course, these signals can come from one language or many languages.
The way I think of the early development is the fetal stage builds up specific predispositions to what we're going to experience later on after we've been born. Babies are not born as a blank slate.
Rather, a kind of groundwork gets laid in utero that familiarizes us with the world we're about to encounter. And if that world has more than one language, we also prep for that in utero.
A lot of language crosses the uterine wall, and so that by the time a baby is born, they're not an inexperienced listener.
Janet Worker is a developmental psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
It's a very multilingual city. We have babies growing up in all sorts of combinations of languages.
including bilingual homes where English and Filipino are spoken, two languages with different spoken rhythms. And Worker wanted to know whether babies exposed to English and Filipino in utero are familiar with both languages at birth, and whether they can differentiate between them. She and her colleagues worked with newborns several hours to several days old. Granted, it's a tricky population.
They don't talk yet. They don't point. They don't follow instructions.
So she wired a pressure sensor up to a pacifier.
Babies will change their rate of sucking, their strength of sucking, and you can condition the sucking reflex.
Which is to say that how much a baby sucks, or how strongly that baby sucks, can tell you how familiar and interesting something is to the baby, like these muffled speech samples that Worker played, filtered to sound like they would in the womb.
In this case, the easiest solution seems to...
This is English.
This is the first time that this international exhibition has occurred in this town.
And this is Filipino.
And the year it been released actually before it can happen.
The results.
From the moment a newborn baby is born who's growing up in a bilingual environment, they listen preferentially to speakers of either of the languages they heard in utero. And they're able to track the rhythmical properties of each. So they're born ready to learn two languages and not confuse them.
Worker says all this learning before birth might be useful. First, it may allow babies to identify who's part of their community once they're born. And second, just from rhythm cues, babies may be able to track how certain words function and give them a head start on learning that language. All this might come in handy when considering early interventions for things like dyslexia. These are still hypotheses, so Worker appreciates a more concrete and intimate lesson, one she's learned by watching the parents watching their babies in an experiment like this.
It communicates to the parent that their baby is interested in the world around them and is interested in learning from the first moments of life. And we like to think that this might make them treat their baby as the curious, involved little being that they are.
Doing well in the world starts with doing well in the womb. So talk to the baby bumps. Play them soaps. They'll thank you later in the words they learn from you. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
In Utero, Seriously Young and Restless, we have more stories on how we learn to speak in the latest World in Words podcast. You can find that at iTunes or at our website, pri.org/language. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Swedish girl runs away from home and unwittingly ends up in ISIS-controlled Iraq.
Oh, I don't think she knew anything. I talked to several people who knew the family and knew her a bit. They said that she was just the kind of person she didn't watch the news.
From Sweden to Iraq and back, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A running away from home nightmare for the age of global terrorism. That's how New York Times reporter Alyssa Rubin sums up this next story. Last year, Marilyn Nevalainen was a teenager living in Sweden. Then her boyfriend convinced her to follow him to Syria, where he was going to fight for ISIS. Marilyn's parents had no idea. And then last month, Kurdish officials announced that they'd rescued Marilyn. Here's how she described living under ISIS.
And when we come to Syria, ISIS took us in a bus with some other women and men to Mosul in Iraq. And after that, I get my house. And in the house, we didn't have anything, no electricity, no water, nothing. And didn't have any money either. And it was really hard life.
I've got the New York Times' Alyssa Rubin with me. You followed Marilyn's story pretty closely, Alyssa, and I gather she and her family are not giving out many details. So tell us what you know about this girl. Start with Marilyn's life in Sweden before she even went to Syria. Why did she run away?
Well, I think we don't really know why exactly she left, but she seems to have been a troubled adolescent. Her family, they had at least four children. We're not sure if they actually maybe had a fifth. And they had trouble with her and voluntarily put her in foster care. And I think they were hoping that the change of scene would somehow help. She dropped out of school at the age of 14, which is obviously not unknown, but quite young. Mm. And it was around the same time that she met her boyfriend, who was the person who really persuaded her to go with him to Syria.
And he was also living in Sweden? What's his background?
He was also living in Sweden. And one thing I should say about Marilyn is she came from a very rural, very sort of pastoral area of farms, woods, small lakes. It's only about an hour and a half from a fairly major city, but it's far away. It's gravel roads.
It's not like she was living in the cosmopolitan world of Stockholm.
No. He was an immigrant from, the boyfriend was an immigrant from North Africa. There are varying versions whether he was, it's a little bit unclear whether he was Moroccan or Algerian. I've heard both. And they met at some point when she was, I guess, had dropped out of school. And during that period when she was 14, going on 15, and began to see each other, he was 5 years older. So quite an age difference.
Right. So you can see why he would kind of hold sway over this teenager. How much did she know about what she was getting herself into when she decided to follow him to Syria?
Oh, I don't think she knew anything. I talked to several people who knew the family and knew her a bit, former neighbors, other people who were very familiar with the family. And they said that she was just the kind of person, she didn't watch the news. That's not what she would have looked at. She would have heard about adventure and he wanted to whisk her away. And I don't think it was something where she had really any understanding or was particularly the kind of person who would have sought out information.
So the other thing about Marilyn Nevelainen when she went to Syria, she was pregnant. What do you know about her experience of becoming a mom living under ISIS rule?
It was probably quite a difficult period. Being pregnant is never entirely easy, certainly not when you're very young. You've never been through it before. We know that her husband was probably away for a good part of that time since he was a fighter. And then during the end of the pregnancy, we don't know exactly when, or perhaps he saw his son, but we're not sure, he was killed fighting in Ramadi. So she became both a mother and then essentially a widow in a very short time.
So let's talk about her rescue. How did she end up in Iraqi Kurdistan, where she was rescued from, and what role did her family play in trying to get her back?
Well, my impression is that her family was very active in trying to get her back, but the exact sequence of events and how they happened are not clear. The purported story is that Kurdish special forces rescued her and brought her to Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. But it also seems that there were probably other people involved, possibly people who were middlemen, trying to organize her rescue through various locals in the area, possibly for payment, although that's not clear. Typically, ransoms are very common for Western hostages, often very high ransoms. So this is a little bit of an odd case because it does not seem that anyone's talking about that
right.
possibility. But somehow she went either directly to the Kurdish forces or she went to some intermediaries who helped facilitate it. And I think her parents and certainly her mother were very involved in trying to help.
A grim one, the story of the Swedish girl, Alyssa Rubin, but thank you for sharing it all the same.
Thank you.
That was Alyssa Rubin with the New York Times. I've got a story now about a civil war, and it's not Syria's. I'm talking about Lebanon, which went through a 15-year civil war that ended in 1990. As many as 17,000 Lebanese are still missing. Some were seized by militias. Others simply disappeared as they went about their daily lives. Now a group in Lebanon has created a website to help loved ones of the missing try to find some answers. Rebecca Collard has our story from Beirut.
The last time Samia Abdallah saw her brother Imad was 1984, when Lebanon was gripped by civil war.
The last picture in my home, he go to Tripoli and disappeared. He was like this, 20 years.
20 years old, on his way from Tripoli to Beirut, Imad vanished. Samia digs through a drawer and pulls out a few old photos she has of Imad. One of him at the beach playing with her youngest son. Another of him on a trip to Germany to visit their brother. She shows me the two things she's kept of Imad's. A cigarette lighter and a brown pajama top he left in her home. She lifts the shirt to her face and inhales deeply, then puts it back in the drawer. For decades, Samia and her family looked for answers. Rumors spread that Imad was stopped at a militia checkpoint and taken to Syria, which had intervened in the conflict.
Nobody help us. Nobody in the government. Nobody help us.
Then, in 2003, the Abdallah family got a letter they believed was from Imad, written with burnt matchsticks and smuggled out of a Syrian prison.
He said, please, my father, my mother, please help me. I miss you. I am sick.
In some ways, the Abdallahs are lucky. They have this glimmer of hope that Imad is still alive in a Syrian prison. He's just one of the thousands of missing whose families are still in the dark.
Most of the families would say he went out to get a cigarette, to visit someone, to bring something that he forgot from the car, and that was it.
That's Rimel Susi. She's with the group Act for the Disappeared. It's just launched a new website, Fusat Amal, which means a space for hope.
And through this space, we can find the way to reinforce the right to know.
Families can post what they know about their missing relatives, but it's also a forum for people to provide information about the missing, even anonymously.
Most of the times when we receive this kind of information, it's anonymous.
So far, around 100 families have posted their stories, and Susi says they're getting more requests all the time.
What the government should have done long time ago is to seriously investigate the fate of these missing people and inform the families of their whereabouts and their fate.
In 2000, the government conducted an inquiry into the missing, but didn't publish that report until 2014. Even then, the report didn't contain information on specific disappearances or people. Susi says that may be because the politicians of Lebanon's government today were the warlords of yesterday.
I think that they might be afraid of being prosecuted. But the good thing is that the families are saying, we don't want to prosecute no one. Just tell us the fate. Let's close this file and move on, all of us.
Without knowing what happened, moving on is hard. Samia Abdallah says every so often prisoners would be released from Syria, and they would say they'd seen her brother Imad.
They said, we know Imad Abdallah. He is very thin, always he sitting alone all the time and not speaking with anyone.
The last time Samia heard anything about Imad was 2008. Then came the civil war in Syria, and with it, hopes that the missing prisoners might finally be released if the Syrian government fell. At one point, there were rumors that prisoners were released when ISIS took control of one town, but nothing came of it. Susi says many families know their loved ones aren't coming back, but they just want to know what happened.
Some families would tell you, I just want one hair to bury or one bone to bury, and then I will be fine.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a Texas abortion case. At issue is a law the state legislature passed in 2013 regulating abortion clinics. The Texas law requires doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic. It also requires abortion clinics to provide facilities that meet hospital-style surgical standards. Lawmakers say the measures are meant to protect women's health, but abortion rights advocates say it's just another way of restricting access to abortion. Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas is the executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. She says if the Supreme Court lets Texas restrictive abortion law stand, it will have an especially negative effect on Latinas in the state.
there are 5.4 million women of reproductive age in Texas. And the Latina population across the whole country is a younger population. So we actually make up the majority. Latina women of reproductive age make the majority of women of reproductive age in Texas. So 2.5 million Latinas of reproductive age in Texas. So this disproportionately impacts us just by sheer numbers, but the additional barriers and conditions that we face pose additional problems. So for Latinas that live in the Rio Grande Valley, close to the U.S.-Mexico border, many of them are immigrants. Many of them don't speak English very well. They're monolingual Spanish speakers. Many of them are undocumented. Many of them are low income. We work in colonias, which are essentially communities that don't have city status and they don't get municipal services. So these are communities that don't have transportation, running water, electricity. The level of poverty is astounding in those communities. And despite that, those women, you know, thrive and survive, but the ability to access even basic health care is extremely limited. The system is very fragile in those communities. So adding the layers that now clinics are facing and thus are shutting down presents almost a de facto ban on abortion for Latinas. Because if the last remaining clinic in the Rio Grande Valley, which is Whole Women's Health in McAllen, Texas, if that ends up closing and if the law stands, essentially women in the Rio Grande Valley would have to drive 3.5 to 4 hours north to San Antonio to get the procedure. And that actually means crossing a border checkpoint.
Latinas in Texas are a diverse group. Is there support among some Latinas for restricted abortion access? Who are your Latina opponents?
So for us, we actually see, and we just came out with a new poll, a national poll of Latino voters, and it actually shows that Latinas are very supportive of abortion access. Despite how they personally feel about the procedure, we find women who are saying, well, I would never get it, or I don't want someone in my family to get it. But if a woman finds themselves in a situation, I would support them. I don't think politicians should be making that decision for them. Despite my faith in the church hierarchy, I believe abortion should remain legal. These were all outcomes of that poll in really high numbers, you know, 80, 90% showed that they support women's access to abortion care, despite how they personally feel about it. And this remains true in Texas as well, amongst Texas Latina voters.
What is the evidence that Latina women are in fact seeking access to abortion?
Latina women are seeking access to abortion. 1 in 5 Latinas will have an abortion in her lifetime.
In Texas?
Across the country. So I don't have the specific data for Texas, but we know Latinas writ large, 1 in 3 women writ large will have an abortion, and 1 in 5 Latinas would in her lifetime.
Jessica, if you just look at the numbers in Texas of abortion clinics, like how many clinics are there now in the state and how many were there, say, 20 years ago?
Well, in the last couple of years, there's been about 42 clinics. After the law passed, we saw about 19 only remain open. And if the law stands, we'll see the number of clinics in Texas go down to about 10. And again, this is to serve 5.4 million women of reproductive age, 2.5 million who are Latinas.
Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas heads the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health in New York. Thank you for your time, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, grab an accordion and a Marshall stack. We invite you to share your favorite Irish punk music on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. There are, what, 4 GOP candidates tonight at the debate? Trump, Cruz, Rubio, Kasich. Everyone else is out of the race. Everyone except Alex Anderson. Mr. Anderson is a telegenic California congressman, or so he would like you to believe. Alex Anderson is not real. He's a character in a novel written by Italian Alessandro Nardoni. But now Nardoni's made Alex Anderson his online persona, and he is, quote marks in the air, running for president. Hello, is this Alex Anderson or is this Alessandro Nardoni?
Hi, I'm Alex Anderson. Hi, Marco. Hello. Hi, everybody.
Let me get this straight. Will you actually be on a ballot? Did you get signatures or are those fake as well?
You know, Alex, for me, is real. His campaign is real because Alex says not fake ideas, but Alex talks about issues in which you really believe.
Well, you're using the third person, so you're talking like Bob Dole, so already you've got some credibility, I got to say.
Alex, of course, is Alessandro because I'm just receiving hundreds of notifications of my on my phone today. I'm proud to be the first one candidate. Okay, I'm a fake, but I'm a candidate that is talking about Orwellian Big Brother.
Alessandro, let me just stop you there for a moment. You're Italian, so technically you can't run for president of the United States. But let me indulge you for a moment. Give us your 30-second campaign speech to become president of the USA.
You know, I think that my speech maybe goes well in Little Italy, but not to the debate. And I just say that I would like that the real candidates in this campaign start to talk about real ideas and not just against Donald Trump. People, I think, in America, like in Italy, want to have money for his family, to have a home, to have a job. And
sorry, Alessandro, let me jump in, or Alex Anderson, let me jump in. You're doing a great job answering this question because you're answering it just like a politician.
In this case, he's a real candidate that stay on his computer talking with the people. He's more real than the real candidates.
All right. Has anyone in the U.S. been fooled by your fake candidacy yet? Have you gotten any emails, any donations that you'll probably have to give back?
Donation, no. If you go to the internet site, you can read that Alex wants just retweets and a lot of emails with invitation to a public debate with other candidates.
Really?
Yeah, really. And a lot of emails from people and said, oh, Alex, I agree with you. And when I answer immediately, they are really surprised. And, oh, wow, you're a candidate. You are running and you really writing to us.
You know, Americans seem to like outsiders this year, Alessandro, but you are really outside, like Italy outside.
Yeah. A lot of outside. I think I'm outside geographically and I'm outside Alex. He's outside for his issues, no?
Alessandro Nardoni, a.k.a. Alex Anderson. You might not find him on the ballot this year still. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you very much. And America is now.
Before we go, a reminder that it is the third day of March. That means we're exactly 2 weeks away from St. Patrick's Day, and we need your help. I guess if you heard the phrase Irish punk, you'd think of these guys, the Pogues. Pogues had their biggest hits 30 years ago, but what about the bands currently carrying on this tradition of Irish punk? Like, who are you listening to? We've been doing our own research here at the show, and the world's Kieran Peterson has been compiling our list. And Kieran, tell us who you found. Any bands that have consistently kind of stood out?
I mean, you're definitely going to find your Dropkick Murphys and your Flogging Mollies, and especially if you ask people around Boston, you'll hear that over and over again. But in my own research, I feel like I've only scratched the surface. I found bands like the Mahones, the Tossers, the Dreadnoughts, and there's a lot more out there.
The Tossers. I don't think you can say that on the radio in England, but here. So are these bands over there? Are they here? Where are they living?
You'll honestly find them anywhere at this point. You'll find bands for sure in Ireland and Northern Ireland. You'll also find bands from Hungary, from Australia, from the U.S. and Canada.
Wow.
There's a tradition of Irish punk pretty much anywhere at this point. But there's one band that I really want to introduce you to. They're called Blood and Whiskey, and they are out of Ireland. They're from Dublin. So just take a listen to this song. It's called Dirty All War.
So I only understood one word, a widow, so that's pretty punk, and that banjo is totally coming off the rails. That's totally punk rock. They seem to fit the bill. It's like Sex Pistols go diddly oi.
Yeah, they really followed like the old tradition from the 80s of kind of the old Irish punk guys. But in a lot of ways, you'll find, at least from my research, I've found that the tone and the style is changing. You'll find a lot more people that are mixing in, or at least accepting more the influences of ska, of indie rock, of really just indie music in general.
And not to mention indie culture, I think we can say. This next song you're going to play is about a cartoon character we know, some of us know, here in the U.S., Brian from Family Guy.
Yeah, the talking dog.
And what band is playing the song Brian?
All right, so the song's called Brian. It's by the Bleeding Hearts, and they're out of England.
Sit down, have a conversation, talk about the world situation, have a smoke and maybe fool around.
Wow, Nirvana meets Irish punk.
For sure.
Take him to a pub and drink it dry. Eating chocolate with martini, playing packing the mill, stewie, raising hell, yeah, deep into the night. Take a walk without a lead, cock your leg with big screen, throw a frisbee in the park and chase the crowd. I want to talk about Brian, the coolest dude in Family Guy.
All right, so these are the Bleeding Hearts. They're from England. Would the Irish still accept them as Irish punk, even though they're from England?
It depends on who you talk to. Sure. I mean, you definitely have the genre of Irish punk music, which might be the same, but also might be different from Irish musicians playing pop music. So that's definitely something that I'm digging into now.
All right, Bleeding Hearts and Blood and Whiskey, two great examples of current Irish punk, Kieran. So what should listeners do if they want to tell us who they're listening to?
All right, if you want to tell me who your favorite Irish punk band is, you go to pritheworld.tumblr.com. I have a call for submissions. You just got to fill out a form, tell me your name, tell me some stuff about them and why they're worth listening to in the first place.
All right, pritheworld.tumblr.com, that's the place to go. And let's just be clear, Irish punk, even if the musicians don't make their home in Ireland or Northern Ireland, what's the deadline?
I'm going to give you guys a week, March 10th, week from today.
Yeah, give us a few days to sort all this out. We'll roll out the list on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. The World's Kieran Peterson. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
From the Nana Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. See you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.